Hi, everybody. If you haven't met me, I'm Gail Watkins. So glad you could join us. Oh my gosh, what is today? For the September 23rd, 2020. 2020 is three quarters of the way over, and that might be a good thing. This is the Platinum Call, and we're going to talk dog breeding. I had a couple questions mailed in, but we'll start with you guys. If whoever would like to unmute and ask a question, and just a reminder, don't be shy. If you're new, you don't have to hang back. Just go ahead and unmute and ask your question or make a comment or discuss something. So I'll turn it over to you guys.
So Gail, I have a question.
Hi, Karen.
Hi.
Hey.
So Ruby had her puppies.
Yeah.
She hasn't dropped her milk yet. Should I be concerned about that? Is there something I can give her to help? She had the puppies Monday.
Right. So today's Wednesday. So we're right at 48 hours, 2 days, yeah. Something like that. And she had a section. Am I right, Karen?
Yeah.
Yeah. So sections do tend to often depress initial milk production, but it isn't at all abnormal. So milk as we know it, as in that cream colored, thicker liquid, comes in between day two and day three. Okay. What's in there right now is colostrum. And we know colostrum is really important for antibodies, but it's also, so we always think parvo and distemper, but in reality, colostrum provides much more. It's got a different kind of energy that really baby neonates can handle better. And it has a wide array of antibodies that aren't specific to diseases. Well, some of them are specific to local diseases. So say, you know, there's mold outside, you know, a leaf mold outside at your home. Well, your girl is immune to that, and she's going to pass that on to her puppies. So beyond distemper and parvo, colostrum provides this huge array of benefits to puppies, but it usually doesn't have the caloric content that milk does. And that's often why we see puppies maintain their weight. And so are your guys losing, Karen, or are they maintaining?
Half of them are, I mean, if they have, a couple of them have lost like not even an ounce.
Okay.
They're, you know, maybe three quarters of an ounce, a quarter of an ounce. Half of them are maintaining or gaining.
Okay.
So I'm making sure that the ones that aren't gaining are on the back end.
And are they the littler ones or is it kind of random weight-wise?
It's random. I didn't have any little ones. They were all pretty much all the same size.
That's great.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that's really wonderful. So, you know, you should expect over the next 24 hours her milk to come in. And one of the ways that milk comes in is from demand. So the puppies, in addition to her hormones, because she's got hormonal changes that are happening, but the puppies are going to drive how much milk she has. And that's one of the problems we have with supplementing too much, is that if we supplement a puppy, it's going to nurse less. And now we kind of get into this vicious cycle. So if they're only down an ounce and they were good-sized puppies, I probably wouldn't do anything until tomorrow except exactly what you're doing, which okay. is make sure they're on the back nipples, make sure they have more time, wake them up. You know, if they're falling asleep, try and wake them up so that they nurse as much as possible. If you see them lose more, like when you weigh them tonight and they're down more, then go ahead and offer a bottle at that point. They really don't need to be tube-fed, unless they're down in the 3-4% loss. And by not filling them up, by just topping them off, you know, so they nurse and then you give them a little bottle, you will maintain their weight and make sure that she produces a good amount of milk. Now, if you're not seeing milk come in by, say, tomorrow evening, then you can start her on galactagogues. So we've got a bunch of stuff in A to Z on galactagogues, which is a really big word for things that stimulate milk production. The one, you can give folic acid, which is beneficial both for the immune system and the ability. So BPA toxins are something that we can protect against. And so that is certainly an option. Fenugreek is probably the most common galactagogue that's given to dogs. So fenugreek.
That's where I can't find. I cannot find it.
You can't find fenugreek?
No.
Where are you located?
Massachusetts.
Walmart? Do you have a Walmart nearby?
Yeah.
Almost always Walmart has fenugreek. Okay. That's where I would go. It's in that huge urban vitamin aisle. Usually comes in capsules. Don't worry too much about dosing. They're all pretty much the same. And you're going to give her maybe 3 to 4 capsules 4 times a day until her breath smells like maple syrup.
Okay.
And then you can either level out and stay at the level that you're at, or you can begin to reduce it. And don't do it cold turkey. You know, reduce it a little over time. Remind me, is she a maiden bitch, or has she had a litter in the past?
Second litter.
And how was her milk production then?
Nothing that I worried about.
So it's probably the combination of the C-section and just a brief time from birth. So I wouldn't rush to too much fenugreek, because what you don't want is over milk supply. You know, if you get too much milk, now you're going to end up with a risk of mastitis. Exactly. So as long as they're active and healthy and not crying constantly and they haven't lost a lot, I wouldn't rush into anything except for maybe giving them a bottle late tonight.
Okay.
Make sense?
It makes sense.
Yeah, and let us know how they're doing tomorrow evening-ish, and if it looks like her milk's come in. What you should be able to get out now, if you milk a gland, is it's kind of a clearish grayish, you know, it's an opaquish clearish. That's colostrum. Cool. Good luck.
I mean, she's nursing. I mean, she wants to nurse them. I mean, she wants to be in here every 2 hours. So
great. Can she be in 24/7?
She could, but one of us would have to be in here 24/7 with her.
Yeah, that's true. But certainly 24/7 is the most natural.
Okay.
Or 12 straight. You know, whatever you guys can do, the more she's in there, the more natural it is and the more likely the puppies will maintain their weight.
Okay.
So as much as you can get her in there, you know, if you're watching a TV show or you're watching a movie or, you know, you're emailing and you've got a laptop, that's a great time to just hang out in there and let them nurse as much as they possibly can. Then they'll fall off and sleep. Then they'll get back on.
Okay.
Good luck.
Thanks.
Who's next, guys? Quiet day today.
All right. I'll ask a question.
Go for it. Who is this? Oh, Sandy. Hey, Sandy.
Sandy, yes. Hopefully this is okay for in here. I have just hired a virtual assistant.
Oh, yay for you.
I know. It's my daughter-in-law, so I feel really good about working with her. And what I've hired her to do for me is, I just, like everybody, I've been overwhelmed with inquiries about puppies. Some days I'm getting 12, and between everything else I'm trying to do, it just takes away from more important things I can be doing. So what I'm curious about, and God bless her, I'm planning to pay her like a flat weekly rate, and then, you know, on of applications, I'll bump it up a little bit more. but I'm wondering, she's going to check emails daily. I told her she doesn't have to check them on the weekends, and it can be, I actually have only asked her for 3 days a week, but she said, oh, I'll probably look every day. I'm curious what other people might do as a base weekly rate. What she'll be doing is the inquiries will go straight to her, and it's just my little generic form. You know, how did you hear about us? Why are you interested in one of our puppies? It's my short form. That gets a response of, hey, thank you. It gives some information about what I have, what I don't have, when I'll be breeding again, and says, if you're interested, we'll send you our application. So it puts the ball back in their court. I'm just curious, what might other people pay as a base weekly fee for something like that?
I'm trying to think of what I pay. I'll have to think about it. I don't know if anybody else has. So a VA is a virtual assistant. These are people who do typically, not always, they can do a lot. They might work a website, they might do social media, but typically we're hiring VAs to do administrative work, such as managing kennel emails are a great, or communications with buyers in some
and
way.
Basically, she's my communications assistant.
Awesome. Yeah, so there's a huge range of going rates for VAs in the United States. I don't know about Canada. I had a Canadian VA a long time ago, but I'm not remembering what her salary was. But it's typically going to be between $12 and $50 an hour. Depending upon, so it's this huge, huge range. And a lot of it depends upon the work they're doing. It's typically paid on an hourly basis with, I'd like you to work this many hours a week. And then there's sort of a negotiation on, okay, so my VA works 5 hours a week for me. She does all my pictures. She does my website, things like that. And she answers puppy emails. She'll send out, she manages my mailing list for sending out birthday notes. So I write them, but she makes sure they get to the right person. So that's usually 5 hours a week. Some weeks it's more, and then she lets me know and I decide if I'm going to kick work to the next week. You know, so she never goes over 5 hours because I pay an hourly. She never goes over five. And she lets me know every week she reports in on how much time she spent and kind of what she spent it on. And if she doesn't hit 5 hours, I personally always have a few projects in my pocket that I would love somebody to finally be able to get to. And, you know, making your application a fillable PDF or, you know, all those things that you, it's really hard to find the time to get to that a VA might be able to get to.
Okay. That gives me a great base. And I noticed that Kelsey just replied to what she does. So in the chat. So that gives me a good place to start. We're just happy to keep the money in the family.
Yeah. As long as, you know, working with family has its pros and cons, because if it doesn't work out, it's awkward. but if it does work out, so Kelsey's doing 20.
Yeah. She pays great attention to detail.
That makes a great VA.
So I'm really comfortable turning this, you know, we've got a starting point, and as we kind of get a feel for how it's going to work, I mean, because she's got a 2-year-old running around at home, you know, we can either decrease or increase what she does. So, yeah. Thanks.
Terrific. Well, good luck. Let us know how it goes.
I will. Thanks. Puppies are doing great.
Terrific. Excellent, guys. Cool. I think I see Aaron on. Maybe Aaron's still on. I don't know if you want to ask your question, Aaron, or you want me to just go through them when I go through the questions. I see Aaron's picture a bit. Okay, I'll wait till she's back or talking before I answer her questions so she can hear them.
Hey, Gail.
There you are. Hey.
Hey,
how are you?
I'm using my husband's computer, so it's taking me a moment to, this is different than mine. Yeah, I had emailed a couple questions. One was about puppy strangles. I had recently had a litter of eight, and one of the puppies had developed puppy strangles at around 5 weeks of age. And the vet office that I saw, they couldn't really explain how or why it develops. And he said it's been more common here recently. And I also had a fellow breeder that one of their puppies also developed puppy strangles. So why it's very rare, I've heard it's becoming more common is what he had told me. So I didn't know if you or anyone else on the call had any insight to puppy strangles. The puppy was treated for about 3 weeks. I kept him later just to make sure that he was healthy whenever he left. He wasn't able to get his vaccination with his litter mates at the same time, so he got vaccinated later. But he's doing well. It was just probably 3 to 4 weeks of treatment and, you know, ensuring that he was healthy and ready to go to his new home.
And was treatment a combination of steroids and antibiotics?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I don't know that puppy strangles is becoming more common. I can't speak to that. I might have a couple of ideas why, if that's the case, but I don't know how much evidence we really have of it. If you haven't experienced puppy strangles, it is a very interesting disease that hits puppies. It can hit as early as 14 days, although that's pretty rare, up to 4 or 5 months. Typically at that point, the risk becomes kind of non-existent. The current thinking on what causes puppy strangles is that it is an overactive immune system. So we know that puppies have extremely immature immune systems. It's one of the reasons that they have trouble fighting off diseases, because their immune system is, it goes out of whack pretty easily and gets overwhelmed pretty easily. So in puppy strangles, their immune system is hyperactive and it starts responding to things that it shouldn't respond to. And so you're often going to get lymph node swelling, and then they'll get pustules on their face. Those are typically the most common. We had a puppy with it, and her neck lymph nodes got so big that she literally couldn't breathe. We had to get her into the vet because it wasn't that she was congested at all. It's just that those lymph nodes were huge. It's kind of remarkable now. So she was probably 2.5 to 3 weeks old, and they were easily the size of an average plum. They were just huge. So the good thing, a lot of times you'll hear people talk about strangles as being an immune problem. And when they say immune problem, they're thinking autoimmune or an immune suppression, a depression of the immune system. And so then people worry about, how is this puppy going to be for the rest of its life? Is it going to get sick more? What's the issue? And since that isn't the case, it is not a suppressed immune system and it is not autoimmune, most puppies, once they get through strangles, are fine for the rest of their lives. They have no more disease. They have no more issues. The downside of the treatment, so the treatment that Aaron's puppy got of typically prednisone or some sort of steroid and antibiotic is the treatment of choice. And in fact, you can just do steroids because steroids calm or suppress the immune system. So you've got this hyperactive immune system and you give steroids and it brings it down. Most vets also give antibiotics. Jackie has the question, is it bacterial or viral? It's neither. It's a simple hyperactive immune response of a baby immune system that has trouble figuring out what it's supposed to be doing. You know, is this a good guy? Is this a bad guy? And they just don't know. So it gets all revved up. But it isn't a pathogen that triggers it. It's simply that puppy. Or we don't know that, say, that puppy came in contact with some pathogen. It's never the same one between puppies. Some pathogen that got it revved up. But it can be absolutely nothing. The puppy doesn't have an infection. There's no evidence that there's strep or staph or any of the more common ones. It's just this immune reaction. Treatment, I have found, Erin, that treatment early, so the puppies that get it very young tend to resolve in 4 weeks, somewhere around there. Puppies that get it older, it can be a much longer treatment for them. And they are the ones that tend to get scarring. Did your puppy have any scarring or any pustules?
No, that I was lucky. I actually caught it when the puppy turned 5 weeks old. I think it was the actual day I was doing photos and I noticed his eye was irritated. And so I had called the doctor. I was going to bring him the next day. And that was in the morning. By the afternoon, when I picked him up to look at him, because I didn't know what it was, I felt the lymph nodes on his neck. So I took him to the emergency hospital and started treatment that day.
That's so excellent. Yeah.
I found it early, luckily. So he had a little bit of loss of hair around his chin, but nothing too extreme like I've seen it in other cases where it began later.
Yeah, some of the pictures online, if you go online and look at puppy strangles, it can be a little bit frightening.
Just the name itself. The name itself, puppy strangles, is,
Especially if you come from horses, because strangles in horses is very, it's more serious, and I believe it's bacterial, but it is a pathogen. I don't know if it's bacterial or viral, but it's a pathogen. It's contagious. Puppy strangles isn't contagious. Might be one puppy every 100. It might be one puppy every 300. I don't think we really have a good idea of its frequency. Jackie says in horses, it's bacterial. So if you come from horses, you're afraid when you hear the word strangles. Why they have the same name for these two completely different diseases, I don't know. Caught early, as Erin did, it is highly treatable. And I'll tell you, I have never heard of a puppy dying of strangles. They probably could because of the size of those lymph nodes. I mean, the lymph nodes are impressive. But the long-term effect on those puppies is usually scarring. And it can be on the face, on the muzzle, around the eyes. It can be pretty ugly. So that's kind of what we know, Erin. And unfortunately, it's so rare that it's not a studied disease. You know, it's not a disease that anybody's really looking at closely. So breeders gather the information and sort of share it with each other. And I think that's one of the reasons that it appears to be more frequent right now, is that we're more connected and we're able to share with each other what's happening. Prevention, no known prevention. Because there's no known trigger for this, that it's just an individual response. And so you may never see another one for as long as you live.
Yeah, Gail, would you recommend that I not do that pairing again? Because my breeder friend that just recently has a puppy, her reproductive vet suggested not to do that pairing again. It was one puppy out of seven, so I don't know.
I don't think it should have any impact on your breeding decisions. It is not from what we know, it is not a genetic issue. It's not an inherited issue. Now, if you do that breeding one or two more times and you get more strangles, that's a whole different story. But I wouldn't do that breeding and go into it thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going to get it. It just isn't that, it's not like hypothyroidism. It's not the like the other immune disorders that we know in dogs. So I don't think I would worry about it. And, you know, this is a little off the record, but I'll say that many, many, many vets that I know, and I'm going to put iVets at the top of this list, but also repro vets and GPs, if a breeding causes a problem, they immediately say, don't repeat the breeding. Or they say, don't breed the parents again. But, you know, if it's a minor treatable problem that will have no long-term effect on the dog, we've got to be reasonable here. So I've heard ophthalmologists say it about a breeding that produced a puppy with dystichia. So dystichia are the extra eyelashes. Of all of the diseases that we look at, 99% of the time, it is completely trivial because eyelashes fall out. You know, so the dog's eyelashes are going to fall out. Usually doesn't bother them long-term if it's just a few. But because the pairing produced a non-perfect dog, they say don't repeat the breeding. Well, if the parents have OFA excellent hips and clear hearts for five generations and are wonderful working dogs and are really beautifully built, to remove them from the gene pool for an extra eyelash in one of their offspring is insanity. It's really a crazy thing to do. So that's my thinking on it, Erin, that we have to track it. We have to pay attention to it. We have to see if it shows up again, but we can't be throwing the baby out with the bathwater if everything else that was produced is fine. A couple people are saying, Sandy said she had one, didn't get in a repeated breeding. Yeah, I think it's pretty minor. April's lived at 12. Ours is 8.5 right now, and a performance dog and never had any problems, and it's good to go. Jen, do you want to ask your semen eval question?
Sure, if we're ready.
I don't know. Let's see.
So just about an hour ago, I had a co-owner go take her mail in for a semen evaluation because we just got a recent request for a natural breeding coming up. So we thought we'd take him in. He's never bred before, never had a collection before. But he was easy to collect. I haven't gotten the report back yet. But the person collecting said his semen was not good enough for a freeze. And they were kind of actually crappy. They were, you know, bent tails and so forth, quite a few. But she did say she would go for it, the natural breeding anyway. I think there was something at A to Z, something about looking into, it was something, I don't know if it was some kind of, there was a case study where some medication was given. You found out something and it was prescribed, and then the semen got improved significantly, whether that's in this case or not.
200 million to 1.2 billion.
Yeah.
That was a very...
What should I check into?
Well, first thing is, how old is he?
He's 5.5.
So he's
middle-aged, yeah.
Middle-aged. And physical exam is normal. Normal-sized testicles, everything else is...
As far as I know, they didn't say anything abnormal at that point, but everything went well with the collection. So
so we do always want to ask the question about firmness and size of the testicles, because in dogs, size does matter. It is important. And a dog that has soft or smaller testicles is not going to produce as well. But they can be they can have as good a breeding desire. Mm-hmm. They just don't have as good a semen. So worth either checking him. Is he close or is he far away?
He's in California, but he's really close to the female, like within 15 minutes of the female.
So. Oh, nice.
Or 10, well, if even that. Yeah.
So you can't check him, but that's one. But the second thing is, if he's never been bred before, that semen is not going to be anywhere near his best semen. And so you're often going to see morphology issues. That's why people do clean out collections.
Yep. That's what I thought I would do before this breeding. Yep.
Absolutely. And was it a bitch in estrus? Was he collected?
Yes. In fact, she called me last night and says, rather than come in Friday, can they come in tomorrow morning? Because we got the perfect one for him.
That's great.
Yes, they understand it.
Terrific. That's wonderful news. So, so it could just be the cleanout collection. There's a huge difference between what is freezable and what will get a bitch pregnant naturally.
That's what she said too.
It's just huge. So, assuming you get a reasonable report that he's not 90% dead or something like that, then there's a good chance that he'll be fine. So the case study that you're thinking of was a young golden, I think he was maybe three, I can't remember, but maybe three. And he was at a repro vet and he had, everything was bent. I mean, it was just a horrible, horrible collection. And the vet said, so I have seen this specific problem with Ehrlichia, dogs that have Ehrlichia. So he was put on long-term doxycycline and given time to clear the Ehrlichia. I can't remember if he was positive on SNAP. I'm not even sure they checked. They just trusted the repro vet, who's an excellent repro vet in Michigan. And his semen came back gangbusters. And he went from really being subfertile, if not infertile, to highly fertile and freezable with that treatment.
Okay.
So it's worth going back. So that's in the semen, the stud dog class.
Should I have him get a tick test?
Harm in it, although California is not huge tick country.
Now, but the vet did recommend that, and this was, again, this was a last minute, so I couldn't advise the owner, but she said that flea and tick treatments close to a collection could affect it.
Well, basically anything can affect it. You know,
sperm
or touchy, little heat, flax, kelp, you know, and for this dog, kelp doesn't hurt it. And the other one it does, they're just really sensitive guys. But, you know, trying to avoid heartworm treatment, flea and tick treatments, it's not a bad idea. But I would definitely, if you think he's going to be used again, get him on Glycoflex.
Okay.
And just leave him on it. You know, it's great for their joints anyway. And for some reason, green lip muscles help semen. And we really don't know why.
Okay.
But it's pretty commonly recommended by repro vets across the country, probably across the world.
Now, other question with that too is, since she will probably be coming into season soon, it would probably be best to not take him in for another one to check, but to maybe wait later on if I want to try to collect for a freeze or
what's soon? Like days or weeks? Or she's a bitch and who knows?
Well, they said September, but October, so, right?
That would be now.
I know, right? It could be any day.
You can certainly, you know, she's most likely, even if you collect them today, she's not going to be breedable in 7 days. And that's really all he needs to regenerate. So I would test him again. You've got the clean out, get the report, see what it says, and do a tick test and try it again.
and get him on Glycoflex and then try it again. How far out?
In a week.
In a week.
Yeah, in a week. Okay. And doxy, if he's got tick disease, doxy does not harm semen. It's not known to harm semen, while okay. some other antibiotics do. So,
so you can
be pretty comfortable there.
Perfect.
Yeah, and Jacqueline does say omega-3 fatty acids. I'm assuming he's on them, but
I double check that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. And he could go, you know, you could put him on, the normal dose is 15 milligrams per pound body weight. You could easily put him on 20.
Okay.
But omega-3 fatty acids, DHA, is wonderful for breeding males.
Perfect, perfect. The cool thing was is I could watch the whole thing over the webcam. No audio, but I was there in essence.
Oh, that's pretty great. Well, and it sounds like he did a good job.
Yeah, yeah.
That's terrific, especially.
So that's hopeful, you know, as far as libido.
And has she been bred before?
Nope. Okay. So two maiden, but I feel pretty good because they're close by and they've got some good resources nearby. I've bred maiden dogs before too.
Sure. Cool. Well, good luck. Let us know.
Thank you.
Post the semen report if you get it.
Okay.
Always good to look at it. Not just what the numbers are, but how the vet's presented.
Perfect.
Because I think there is a different presentation form for every.
If I could read them, I told him to write them legibly because I've used them in the past and it's like reading doctor prescriptions.
Oh, some of them are just, and they do the little annotations. And I have no idea what this means.
Right.
Great.
Thank you.
Teresa, do you want to unmute or want me to? I see. There you are.
Hey.
Hi. Hey.
So I'm looking to breed a maiden bitch. She's 3 years and 11 months old. She's a pup I raised from home from her mom here in the house. And I have a male dog that lives in the house with us as well. And he shows the least interest in this bitch for whatever reason throughout her heat cycles. I've also got his daughter in the house from the breeding I did as well, and he pays more attention to her than this one. I don't understand. Is there something in her cycle that she just doesn't present, or her personality? Don't know.
It could be both, although usually it's the girls that are more selective than the boys, but it's certainly possible. Have you tracked any of her seasons? Have you done cytology or?
Yes, not cytology. I did a progesterone test her last cycle just to see what she was like.
Yep. And what was she like?
Her numbers are good and she runs about 13, 14 days and then she ovulates and is, and then has the spike. So she's got a short cycle. Her mom runs generally not till the 17th day. Is she ready?
Wow. Oh, that's a long cycle.
Yeah.
So it could simply be, so typically with males, it's going to be odor of some sort.
Yes.
And, you know, progesterone and estrogen are strong stimulating odors for male dogs. Her urine is going to be really important. It's the thing that gets most males going. So I don't know how much I would worry about it if you know her progesterone rose and that she was at a normal level, because often if you have an anovulatory cycle where the bitch never gets a high progesterone and never ovulates, those, is this an experienced stud, Doug?
Yes, he's, he bred the female in the house and then he's done an AI, sent it to Seattle and got puppies. So yes, he's had pups. And the male I'm looking to use is never bred. He's 2 years old and in the States, I'm in Canada. He's just visiting from Denmark. So they would like to get used.
So. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
An experienced stud dog who has bred, usually it takes more than once naturally, but some boys figure it out pretty carefully or pretty quickly that there's really no reason to get particularly excited until ovulation.
Yeah.
And they're going to limit how long they're going to be really excited about her to the 3 or 4 most important days. So that's possibly it. It can be her temperament. So I don't know if she's the dominant bitch in the pack or the bottom.
I would say he pays great attention to the older bitch in the house. And that's where his focus is. But I do see him getting more interested in his own daughter.
Of course. And, just be so helpful for you.
Wouldn't it? Stay away. Where this one's in the middle. And yeah, she has a different play with him. She'll get right in his face and clean his mouth and plays more of the submissive puppy role. And the daughter's always done that as well, but for whatever reason, these two have a bit of a different relationship, and I don't know if that plays part of it, but anyway.
It can, although as I said, the boys are usually less discriminating than the bitches. You know, bitches will often say, I'm not breeding a dog that I live with. I'm just, I won't breed to a dog that's in the house.
Yeah.
The boys typically will breed anything that will stand for them at the right moment. But in this case, it may be their relationship that he doesn't feel comfortable with it. He doesn't feel like she's mature enough.
Yeah.
But it shouldn't matter if you're, are you shipping in semen?
Yes, I'll bring semen in from the U.S. to do this.
And, yeah.
The girls certainly pay attention to each other, you know, cleaning each other and urinating on each other's spots and stuff. So
So I don't think, as long as you've checked the progesterone, I don't think I would be concerned about it. You're less likely, hopefully, to have a oops breeding. Not going to need the stud dog you're using to like her. So should be pretty straightforward.
Well, and listening to when you and Jen talked about, you know, breeding to first timers, it's always that little bit of a questioning is if it's all going to go well. And I guess my other question is with the stud dog, should I ask that they do a semen evaluation on that semen? We've only got like 7-10 days before breeding time to do this. So we're kind of on the...
Does he have a current litter on the ground?
No, nope, he's never bred.
That's right. You said he's never bred. Yeah. I would have them do a semen evaluation if they can do it tomorrow.
And I don't know if they've ever collected or done anything with them. So,
yeah. So they'll need to find a repro vet. You said they're in the Northwest. Is that right?
They're in Tennessee.
Oh, Tennessee. Well, they can certainly go to a repro vet in Tennessee. The timing may not work out. If they can't get it done like this week, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, I would say skip it. Are you doing 2 shipments?
Probably 2 collections and shipping them once.
Together.
Yeah.
As long as you're going to do 2 collections, because that first collection may not be very good.
Right.
And you just don't want that to be your only breeding collection.
Yes.
Yeah. You want that second one.
Yeah. Okay.
Good luck. Let us know.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah. No kidding. They're crossed. I got it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks Teresa.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Hey, Lynn. I see you on there. I don't know if you can unmute. 3-week-old puppies that moms are trying to leave the puppies after feeding for 5 minutes. Pups are gaining weight. Hey, Lynn.
Yeah.
Not unusual.
Okay.
Yeah. Pretty.
A little bit earlier than last time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, she may have learned her lesson last time that teeth are coming. One, I don't know if it's a smaller litter or the puppies are bigger, but they can often empty. By 3 weeks of age, they can often empty a bitch very quickly. And when the puppies are young, the bitch is fine with hanging around with the puppies when she's empty. But typically, between 3 and 4 weeks, they stop hanging around.
Okay, because she'll sit outside the pen, and then the puppies see her and cry.
Right, right. Oh, that's...
They're full, and I can see they're gaining weight, but I'm just like, okay.
So one of the things that I always recommend is try to have some of the day's nursing happen outside the pen. Because a lot of times the bitch doesn't want to go in the pen. It isn't that she doesn't want to be with her puppies. She just doesn't want to get trapped in there with them. You know, because it's much harder to deal with them at 3 weeks. They're moving, they're running, they're grabbing. So you may just try, you know, it's a good opportunity for them to get outside the pen, go into the kitchen, go into the living room and have her nurse them in there and see if she's more accommodating there.
Okay. I had two other quick questions.
Sure.
One is, one of the puppies was born with like a kink in the tail.
Uh-huh.
So is there anything wrong with that? Or I've had some vets tell me before, so I had it happen before with the same dog.
Oh, interesting.
And it was just the way that like maybe another puppy was pressing up against it inside. I don't know.
Not usually. So where is the kink? In the tail. Is it at the end? Is it close to the anus?
About the middle.
Middle. So usually the further they are from the anus, the back of the dog, the less impact they're going to have on the dog. And so, you know, there's nothing wrong in the sense that if you're selling it as a pet or a performance dog, it should be perfectly fine.
That one will be a pet, probably.
Yeah. And if it's a serious kink, is it a 90-degree angle or is it just you can feel it? Can you see it?
It's not a 90-degree, but you can see it.
So the debate is, will the tail get damaged? And docking is an option, but at this age, at 3 weeks,
it's a sheltie, so it'll have fur on it, so you right. Probably won't be able to even see it.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, that's how his mom has a kink in her tail.
Aha! Uh-huh. Well, there you go. So
the breeder told me it's not genetic; you just
it is
the show ring.
It is
okay.
It's not always inherited. In some ways, we aren't really sure what causes it, but it is rarely a broken tail, which often is what breeders first think it is. The bitch stepped on the puppy's tail or something like that. And it's rarely caused in utero. It's usually nutritional. It is inherited, or it's a random thing that happens in dogs. But if mom has it and mom's passed it on, you can be pretty sure it's inherited. Okay. And so then you breed carefully. It's certainly, of many of the genetic issues we have, it's not a huge concern as long as the kink isn't a really bad kink and you end up having to dock the tail, or if it's close to the anus, and that sometimes can indicate sort of spinal issues, internal issues. But when it's towards the end of a tail, it usually has no impact on the puppy.
Now, I kept her daughter and I'm raising her for breeding in the future. Do you think she might have some?
Yeah, probably.
Okay.
Probably. So, you know, it's a question to ask stud dogs as your, it's not the opening question to ask a stud owner, but it's worth sort of casually having the question because you prefer not to double up on it if you can. You just don't want them to get severe.
Okay. And is there any way, my stud dog, he breeds really well naturally, but sometimes he has a hard time finding the spot.
Oh,
and he's
yeah.
Breeding the same girl.
He's breeding the same girl?
And, well, I have two females, right? And one is half an inch taller. and he has the hardest time getting her. But the other one that's a half an inch shorter, he gets her just fine. But sometimes it's like he's standing there trying to get her. And the slightly taller one, she's like, okay, I'm fed up with you. I'm leaving.
Yeah, exactly. Get on with it.
She only got Fred once last time, but she had six puppies.
Oh, good.
But it's like frustrating with me with trying to breed him because it's like, don't you know what you're doing? You already did this already.
Now, remember, he's doing it blind. Just saying. You know, it's not like he can see what he's doing. A half an inch is a big deal in a Sheltie. You know, that's a fair amount of room. If it's a half inch in a Golden, we're usually trying to take steps to assist in the breeding, and they're a lot bigger than Shelties.
Yeah, I'll use a towel, fold it up and stuff like that.
A hill, a towel, a board. The problem with any kind of wood board or anything is that he's got to move his legs forward once he has tied her, and he'll often step off. So you have to make sure that he can stay on it and she's not on it so that she doesn't get elevated too. Otherwise you don't quite solve the problem.
Well, he does this happy dance after he
Exactly. gets tied.
So he basically is riding her after he breeds her.
And does he turn?
Sometimes.
So help him turn, because you're going to get a better tie and it's easier on the bitch.
Okay.
So, you know, once he's in and, you know, they do the happy dance and then there's kind of a calm, that's a time to help him turn.
Okay.
But the other thing, Lynn, is that because she is that much taller, you want to make sure that she is ready to breed. So what happens with the vulva, even after the LH, at the LH surge, the vulva is what's called turgid. It's firm. And as she progresses to the point where the eggs are ripe, so that's 2 days after ovulation, the vulva becomes pillow-like. It becomes super soft.
Yeah.
And if a boy is struggling, it's often because the vulva isn't at the point where it's soft enough. And so you may want to sort of focus in on how he's doing at each stage. She may be willing to stand the day after ovulation, but because the vulva's not soft enough, he may not be able to breed her. And often 12 hours or 24 hours can be enough to make the difference.
Okay.
So that's another thing. And it's hard on the bitch to have them thrusting away and nothing's happening. And it can be hard on the dog. I know, especially a bitch that's a little higher in the pecking order is usually like, seriously, I'm done. You don't get to do this anymore. And you don't want to annoy her and you don't want to exhaust him. So focus in on that and see if you can find the point where she's really ready and he can tie her more easily.
Okay. Because I'm trying to find another boy, another stud, because I want a try to breed with her. But so far I haven't found one, so.
Well, keep looking, but he may still be able to do it if you're happy with what they've produced. Just maybe it's a little harder for him. Do you have a hill? Because we use hills.
Yeah, we have lots of hills.
Yeah, so we just put
our farm's all on hills.
There you go. Yeah, I kind of live in a similar place. So put him uphill and try and aim her downhill, and often that can make a huge difference.
It's just funny because my other female, she'll just go and get bread. Like one time she's going to work and she just waltzes out there to go to the bathroom and
tied.
I'm like, I'm gonna be late to work.
Short tie, girl. I didn't think
she was quite ready yet, and she apparently thought she was.
Those are really good brood bitches. They'll breed anytime easily. Terrific. Well, good luck, Lynn.
Thanks.
I got had a question about malformed forelimbs in puppies as a random mutation, et cetera. So we don't really know about limb deformations that are just a single limb. That, unlike tails, can be a large litter crammed in together. And I know this isn't the case in Laureen's situation, but it also can be a bitch that's not in great condition. So if you look at a bitch that has, say, an average to a large size litter and she is not very fit, you will see that the puppies tend to be carried very low in the abdomen. And they're kind of piled on each other. And then if you look at a really fit bitch, that's when the puppies are distributed throughout the abdomen. You can see it if you're on the canine fertility list and you're looking at some of those x-rays that are put up. When you see what I call pile of puppies, so you see puppies all piled at the bottom of the abdomen, you can be pretty sure if it's not so late in the pregnancy that the litter is dropped, that she is not very fit. So she's not core fit. She doesn't have core fitness and she's not able to hold up the weight of the puppies. That can increase the likelihood of deformities in puppies, particularly for large litters, because they're all kind of piled on top of each other and there's no way for them to have space. Other than that, it's like people. You know, not everything goes right in dogs, and it's not always inherited, and it's not always caused by something we've done. It just happens. And so we never want to just write it off. We always want to try to figure out what happened, but sometimes there just isn't going to be a cause that we can figure out. Laura had a stud dog with prostatitis and it was treated. Can it be used for natural breeding? Sure, if he's got semen, Laura. Has he had a semen evaluation? Or do you know? I don't off the top of my head know the antibiotics that affect semen. So
I don't know whether he's had a semen evaluation afterwards.
So you definitely want to make sure that he has been checked 60 days after treatment and that he has good semen, that there's not blood in it, that he's got enough of it. But yeah, absolutely. They can be treated for prostatitis. It will probably come back, but not always. You know, sometimes it's just a random infection that they get. Are you thinking of using him?
Oh, I used him when he was diagnosed, but we got frozen from him.
Yeah, that's usually, if they have bad prostatitis, usually they're not going to breed, you know, because they're in a lot of pain.
Right. So we did frozen and it was successful and the pups are 7 weeks old, love these puppies. And I could imagine using this stud again. So I just want to make sure that.
Yeah. So let him get through it and then talk to his owner and see if he can get a semen eval.
Okay.
Terrific. Great. Hopefully he'll bounce back. April, I can't see you, but it looks like you're on
here. I'm here.
Hey, there you are.
I'm here.
You're on page two.
Oh, that's a lot of people.
There are. Yeah. So 3-year-old stud dog and bark panel, one copy of the variant associated with ALT activity.
That's with his liver.
It's just, I don't know why they do that test. There's no evidence that that test has results that actually affect puppies, the dog, anything at all.
Okay. I am going to do it again in a different company, obviously.
We talked
about this, but
not a lot of companies run this test. It just happens to be a test. You know, Embark will add to their chip any tests that they feel have been confirmed scientifically. But that doesn't mean that it's actually a disease or a problem or an issue or an anything. So the only thing we have to worry about on that test, and frankly, I have dogs with it and we've never worried about it, is you give it to your vet. And when the ALT, so when you run your annual blood work on your dog, that this dog's ALT may be in the low end of normal without any problem. There's no liver issue. It's just natural for this dog.
I was wondering that part. Yeah.
That's it. I've had a lot of dogs with this mutation and they have never had low ALT results all the way through 14 and 15 years of age. So I find, I don't like this test with Embark because I think it worries people for absolutely no reason.
And I have somebody that wants to use him. And I, of course, offer all his genetic testing. You know, he's got excellent hips. He's got an echo on his heart. He's a golden retriever, right? So, you know, and he's three generations of my breeding. And I'm like, and then this comes up and I'm like, I never it didn't even dawn on me that was there. Like, he's
pure. It's literally nothing. It's nothing. Okay. Ignore it. And if you're.
But how do you get somebody else to ignore it? That's the problem.
Yeah. So, I mean, she can certainly call Embark. You could email Embark. Okay. They've got reasonable customer service. You'll probably hear back from them in a reasonable period of time. Yeah. Within a week, I would guess. It's not going to happen if you're breeding tomorrow.
Right.
And I think that they will support this, that this is simply not an issue. And this is something that we have to worry about as more and more genetic tests are done. And companies like Embark are going to add them to their chip, even though they're meaningless, they are nothing we need to be concerned about. You could breed a dog with both low ALT genes to another dog with both low ALT genes, and it will mean nothing in the puppies for a lifetime or with the dogs themselves.
It's crazy.
So it's crazy. It really is. Yeah. And I understand what Embark is trying to do, but that's one, because it pops up. You know, it's at the top of your page.
It is.
And it does. Your dog. Exactly. Exactly. And I think it should be in really small font on the report somewhere, but it's what they do. So I think that they'll confirm it for you. I would, you know, unless I don't even know how you address it with the breeder, because you don't want to act like you're hiding it, but you also don't want to call attention to it. You know, it's.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm an open book. I'm in a glass house. I am who I am. My dogs are who they are, and I'll let you know, whatever. But that was like, what? How is he? He's never showed a sign of having any issues in his, well, he's only three, right? He's working on his fifth litter. I'm waiting for my girl to come in and then, you know, obviously being more of a proven stud. And so it was, oh my
gosh. It's nothing.
You go through all these hoops and then there's that.
So, I know. Like,
oh,
I know.
Oh my God.
I don't know if
what
there's...
other panel would you use? So I'm willing to go pay, you know, whatever to go have another panel done.
UC Davis just came out with their golden retriever panel. It looks very good. It's $130, so it's not hugely expensive. So you can go to UC Davis, or just Google UC Davis Vet Gen, VETGEN, Veterinary Genetics Lab, and look for the golden retriever panel.
All right, I'll do that. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Great. Good luck, April.
Thank you.
Lorene talks about tail kinks in her current litter because I think it is genetic in Entlebuchers. Of all the breeds, because you can dock. So my understanding is that you can have dock dogs or not dock dogs. And so this is a gene I think that was embedded very early in that breed and is there. But I don't think it's the same gene as it is for other breeds. So yes, I do think it's genetic in your breed. And Jen, I didn't even see your comment. But yes, you agree. Okay, I'm reading the conversation. Kelsey, really interesting point. I've wondered why my girls seem to carry much higher than others in my breed. I think it's core fitness. Really, really good support for Fit to Be Tied, because going for walks isn't going to get you core fitness. You've got to focus on core. Like human beings, dogs will not develop their core unless we push them. And we can't, well, you can do crunches with dogs, but that's way at the end of their core training, but you can do some basic stuff. Okay. More comments, questions, where are we at? Oh, just a little bit over. Any last questions? You unmute yourself, toss them in, going once, going twice. Okay, two reminders. Tomorrow, 3 p.m., all about poop. We will dig into something that is ubiquitous in our lives. We see it every day. We carry it around. We pick it up. I always say that, you know, in 1,000 years, there are going to be people who are trying to understand why we saved all of our dog's poop, because it's all going to be in plastic bags sitting there in landfills, and it won't have deteriorated at all. And they're going to be thinking, what was the matter with these people? October 21st, 2 p.m., potty training your litter. We will have an email out for that. I'm just following the limb deformity. Jackie Mattson says popular sire with limb deformities in his litter. Yeah, there, you know, mutations, every dog carries mutations, and the vast majority of them are not fatal, but there are probably in every dog and every human being 4 really serious mutations. Those mutations don't necessarily have to be spread throughout a breed. They may be just that dog's mutations. And so we as breeders are always trying to figure out, is this an issue in the breed, or is this just a mutation that happened in that dog? So that's why we track pedigrees. That's why, go back and watch the using pedigrees to breed great dogs and how important it is, regardless of the breed or crossbreed that you produce. Pedigrees really matter for this reason. Okay, last call.
Hi, Gail.
Yeah, hey.
Gail?
Yeah.
I've been on mute the whole time. I think you can hear me.
I can hear you now.
You can hear me now. I sent in a question.
Oh, yeah.
I guess that was going to be addressed.
I'm sorry, I forgot. I've got it right here. This is about lymphoma?
Yes.
Yeah. So this is a golden retriever who died of lymphoma. Frozen semen's available. Should it be used? So not an easy decision to make, but I'll give you, because Goldens are my breed, I'll give you the information that I have and my perspective. So right now, 60% of golden retrievers die of cancer. The 2 dominant cancers that we find in our breed are hemangiosarcoma and lymphosarcoma. And unlike in other breeds, the lymphosarcoma that golden retrievers get is T-cell lymphoma, and it's close to 100% fatal in a very short period of time. Unlike B-cell lymphoma, where you can usually get a dog into remission and then get a dog back into remission, and you might get a couple of years, that's rarely the case in golden retrievers. So we also have histiocytic sarcoma, which if you've got a breed that like flat coats or burners that have that, it's a nightmarish cancer. So we have this sort of collection of cancers that are unbelievably common in our breed. And years and years ago, I produced a puppy with histiocytic sarcoma. So I went to the University of Pennsylvania and worked with one of their oncologists, was not able to save her. But I walked into her back office, not her treatment room, and she had a regular sized office, and one entire wall was covered with one golden retriever pedigree. And this was the pedigree that she felt was the center of mass for related soft tissue sarcomas in golden retriever. And they were, in her opinion, the same gene. So they were caused by the same gene, and that's hemangiosarcoma, histiocytic sarcomas, lymphosarcomas. Osteo may be in there, but osteo isn't a soft tissue cancer, so we're not sure whether that's it or not. So fast forward a couple of, you know, maybe 7 years, the UC Davis started a cancer in golden retriever study. Golden retrievers are the most studied cancer breed in the world, which is not a good thing for your breed. You know, we have the Morris Animal Foundation, largest cancer study ever done in dogs. So UC Davis went looking for the gene that caused these soft cell cancers in golden retrievers. I put one of my dogs in, and every 2 years they called and checked in, and she passed away at 14, and they called me just to check in on her, and that was about 18 months ago. And so I was talking to the guy. I said, you know, she died of leukemia at 14. And he said that their research is showing that at least in golden retrievers, and they haven't added any more breeds, that cancer prior to 12 is genetic. It is inherited. Well, if you are in golden retrievers or you know golden retrievers, not many of them live to 12. They're dying much, much younger than they used to. And it is probably because of this gene. Now, they have not published this paper yet. And I actually have not touched base back with him again since my dog was out of the study. I just haven't had time to do it, Terry. But I think that there is a very high likelihood that the cancer that he had is an inherited cancer. It's very strong in both of our main lines, field and confirmation. If you go back in pedigrees and you look at Great Teddy Bear, one of the dominant sires, he died at 6.5 of cancer. I mean, it's just throughout our pedigrees. So it's probably inherited. Whether to use his semen or not is your decision. You have to think through how much you want to weigh that. It's one of the reasons that I breed two older golden retrievers. I want to see that they've lived at least 8, which is the year that goldens get cancer. And ideally they've lived to 10. I've bred to 13-year-olds before, but not many of them are still breeding, producing semen, enough semen. But I would say if we don't start focusing on longevity in golden retrievers, it's just gonna get worse. And it's kind of hard to imagine that it can get much worse since I have a friend that lost, out of a litter of 6, lost 3 of them before 2 to cancer. It is a heartbreaking breed. So I don't know. It's probably not very good news, Terry, but.
You're already confirming my deal. I kept a son from him and my girl. I finally bred him to my girl, kept a boy, you know, so I'm just like, what's the point?
Yeah. Well, it's why a lot of people leave goldens because of it. So what can you do? You can hold off on breeding him until he's 8, 9. Watch as litter mates. Watch Max's litter mates. See how long they live. Look at those pedigrees and search for a pedigree full of dogs who live to 12 or older, and use your stud dogs late. Use them very late. This golden died of lymphosarcoma, and Terry, remind me, was he was 7.5?
7 years and 4 months. T-cell lymphoma. It's a ticking with some. I'm surprised that the oncologist can tell me,
That it was T-cell and there wasn't much hope?
There wasn't much hope.
It's so hard because we want desperately to save the dog and the oncologist wants to save the dog, but with T-cell lymphoma and Goldens, it's very unlikely to get more than, if you get 3 months, it's a lot. It's a lot. You got 3 weeks. I'm so sorry. He was such a magnificent dog. I'm just so sorry. Jen's sorry, go ahead.
I'm just trying to do the right thing. I mean, I'm just starting out and I've only been in Golden 7 years and 4 months or 8 years now, but where are my roads going to take me?
It is such a difficult breed because if you look at the pedigrees that are winning today, almost none of them have more than one dog in the pedigree that lived past 12. They're rife with very, very early cancer. So for me, early cancer is before 9. And that's, you might get 9.5. And so we're breeding and we're line breeding on these pedigrees that are just concentrating this gene for cancer in our pedigrees. I don't know how we're ever going to dig out of it, frankly.
So there's no test for a gene, right?
Not yet, but that's a reason to collect and freeze your boy if you're really happy with him. And collect him a fair amount so that you can use one of those straws to genetic test if and when we get this test for this gene. And the strange thing for me is we often think cancer is going to be polygenic, which means there's a lot of genes that are affecting it and that it's environmental. But when I spoke to that researcher at UC Davis, he said, it's not polygenic in Goldens. Now, it may be in other breeds, and it is not environmental in Goldens. If the cancers that Goldens got were environmental, then your Entlebucher would have cancer at 6, or your Labrador would have cancer at 6. But Goldens, flat coats, boxers, burners, but Goldens as a large breed have earlier and much higher rates of it. So what could it be? It could be that this gene doesn't actually cause the cancer, but it allows an environmental impact. So it makes them more sensitive to something in the environment. But if you look at Goldens, this range of cancer is across North America. So it's not ticks, it's not water, it could be air, but it isn't the very specifics in our locations. And so as we think about breeding them, it's just so difficult. So as you want to do the right thing, Terry, is if you want to continue to show in confirmation, it is really hard. It is incredibly difficult to find a top winning dog that is going to give you a pedigree that will avoid cancer.
Right.
I know it's terrible. It's just,
it's funny how, I got into this 7 years ago and I've seen more cancer this year. I mean, every year it keeps getting worse. And more young dogs, you know, 7 years old, 6 years old, 5 years old. I'm just like, what's going on?
It's, you know? I think you're right. And we are seeing more and more and more. And I think what's happening is, and this pertains to all breeds, that we are line breeding heavily without knowing we're line breeding, because the dogs we're line breeding are so far back in the pedigree that we can't see them anymore. So if you go to ITDB, Introduction to Transformational Dog Breeding, there is a poodle pedigree there that that dog is so inbred, just completely inbred, but the dogs it is inbred on are not visible in a 10 generation pedigree. Cannot see a single, or you know, maybe there's a couple repeated dogs. Actually, I don't think it's a poodle. I think it's a setter. Gosh, I'm gonna have to go pull it up. And so we are doing that in many of our breeds because we don't look back far enough in the pedigrees to be able to see the influence of these early dogs. And so, for example, Great Teddy Bear and Golden Retrievers, I'm not sure I could find a reasonably successful show dog in the United States or in the United States. Canada has more genetic diversity. In the United States, that doesn't have Teddy Bear in there multiple times. And he dies at 6.5 of cancer. So that's now being compounded and compounded and compounded in our pedigrees. So as you look at your breedings, go back and look past, if you can. Now, some breeds you can't. You don't have a lot of information past 10 generations. And some breeds, you don't have a choice. You know, if you're going to breed the breed, you have to line breed. But know the dogs you're putting in there most heavily. And above all, try to find out what they died of. Because we are very good at making hip information available. We're very good at making eye information available. We are awful at making cause of death information available to future generations. Most of us have no mechanism to do it. We don't have a way to share that information. And if I read one more time a breeder that says, well, they can pick up the phone and call me, I'm like, well, you're not living forever. I hate to tell you this. I don't want to share it, but someday you aren't going to be there and somebody may need that information. So, okay. Go ahead.
Dogs, I know way over. But like for me personally, who I fell in love with the breed mainly because it's my boy, and I'd like to continue. I'm kind of like, I don't know where to go. I don't know. Is there a database? I don't know where to start. It's like, you know, the litter that I feel most responsible is the one I just bred. So now I have, you know, 12 souls out there that I worry about, because that's the kind of person I am. I would never want to. I mean, you can't breed a perfect dog, and you can't. You try and do everything right and shit still happens. Like, you know? But I just want to try to do.
So I think what you do, Terry, because I had that happen. I waited and bred to a dog 8, and he died when my puppies were 8 weeks old of hemangio. And I had selected him for longevity. And I lost most of those puppies earlier than my average. So what I do is that I coach those owners. What do they need to do? Feed the cleanest diet they can possibly feed. Use nomographs and titers to do their vaccinations. Give a ton of DHA. I personally give 30 milligrams per pound body weight to my dogs because they're golden retrievers and cancer is prominent. It's one of the reasons I feed raw, because there's very few carbohydrates in there. And the way I think about it, and this is 100% personal, guys, I'm not making a recommendation, but the cancer starving diet that we put dogs on when they get cancer has no starches in it. And so my thinking is, why don't I raise my dogs on that diet and keep them on it for life? Because I want to starve those cancer cells before they have time to start multiplying. And so my dogs live on a cancer starving diet, and I give them everything I possibly can. So that's what I coach my owners, Terry, and they may or may not follow it, but I am, and weight, exercise, not fitness, exercise, that these dogs are regularly exercised, high levels of DHA, the best diet they can possibly feed them. Vegetables. So we only have it from the Westie or the Scotties, but vegetables significantly reduced cancer in those dogs. And that's published. So that's kind of how I look at it is.
Right.
I'm coach and guide.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry, I got emotional.
Oh, I totally understand it. I totally understand it. I really appreciate you trying to figure it out, like hugely, hugely. Yeah. Not enough people are doing it. April made a comment about she had a dog that passed from lymphoma at 8 and she has Frozen that she hasn't used. He's from British Lines, which I think is really important. If you read a lot of websites in the United States, it'll say British Lines don't have cancer, while American Lines do. They don't have as much, but they still have a fair amount. The breed itself is really at a difficult time. Jacqueline's talking about breed clubs started issuing longevity certificate. I know Dobie's did that a while ago. I don't remember your breed. I'm sorry, Jacqueline, but not at all. I think it's a great thing for clubs to confirm dogs who live beyond 12 or something like that. They certify those dogs so that in the future, we know dogs that have lived to a reasonable age. And maybe if you've got Papillons, it's 14. But in Goldens, it would be nice just to know at 12.
Right.
Okay. Good luck, Terry. Yep.
Thank you.
Hang in there. Yes. Yeah, so we have a lot of comments about genetic diversity, the genetic testing at UC Davis that Better Bred uses. That's if you've got a breed that has problems with cancer, that's a great place to go. You've got to get your breed into it. But the folks at Better Bred, Natalie and Rebecca, will definitely help you. Crystal's talking about a breed that goes back to just a handful of founding dogs. This is an issue for many of our rarer breeds. There's nothing you can do to change that except keep every possible genetic variant that you can in your breed. So those breeds need to know their genetic diversity, and they need to intentionally bring those dogs, maintain those dogs in the gene pool, even if they aren't champions. They don't have the best type. They don't have the prettiest heads. They get bred to maintain genetic diversity, because once a breed with a closed stud book has lost a gene, it can never go back in again. We can never put genetic diversity back into a breed with a closed stud book. The only way we can do it is to breed to another breed. And so it's one of the reasons I so strongly supported UC Davis's genetic diversity. If you look at what the standard poodles did, they did a global search for every kind of pedigree they could find. Rare pedigrees in the Far East and Russia, they went everywhere so that they could get a map of their breed's genetic diversity and be more intentional keeping those dogs with very rare genes in. Unfortunately, my breed didn't quite take that approach, but that is a really valuable way to use it. Lynn, I do have the link for the Westie information. I will put it on Facebook. Will that be good? Edges.
Yes, that's fine.
Okay, good.
Great. But why do breeders that are showing champion dogs seem to hide some of these things? Because as a breeder, I've gone to shows and looked at some of the dogs that are winning, some of the Shelties that are winning, and there are certain things in those dogs that I wouldn't breed. But they'll hide them, or unless you really know what to look for.
We are by nature an extremely competitive community. We really like to win. And unlike communities, like if you look at cattle, where there are databases of what a bull has produced and what his kids have done, and they measure the kids, and all of these things are put into a public database. In dogs, they are our family members, and we feel so much more personally attached to them that when we admit our dog has a mistake or a disease or a problem, it's like we're admitting our kids do. And we are not a community that has been forced to do that. We have not been in a community that has embraced that public information. Look at racehorses. You know, you look at other species and all of that information is available, but in dogs, we do hide it. And there has not been, you know, who could fix this? The AKC, the CKC, but
they don't want to do anything extra.
They don't. No.
I asked them because my dog had 10 puppies and I thought that was a record for a Sheltie. And they said they couldn't tell me what was the record litter size for a Sheltie.
They don't know. It's not their thing. And so we're stuck with all of these separate communities, you know, the field golden retrievers and the Quakerhund and show labs, and we have all these stovepiped communities that don't share information and aren't pushed to. And we tend to finish a young male and breed him without really seeing, you know, who is he as an adult, and, you know, can we wait until he's six or something? So we have a system that does not support seeking longevity, and we have a system that does not support honesty. Because if you're honest, but other people in the breed are not, then you lose because it looks like you're the only one that has the problem. And so it is, it's one of the reasons I started Avidog. It's one of the reasons I tell everybody to take ITDB. Because that's what ITDB is all about, is how do you begin to handle these situations?
What is ITDB?
Introduction to Transformational Dog Breeding. It's okay. It's one of your courses.
Okay. I just didn't recognize it.
Yep.
Holly, stop.
It's a Sheltie. Yeah. Take your time going through that course, go back and go through it again and really read the stuff to say, okay, I took it when I first got in the breed, you know, 3 years ago, but now I know so much more. I'm going to go back and look at it again from that perspective, especially how am I selecting my breeding stock? Okay. And you have to change your strategy as you get more information, because otherwise we're just digging ourselves into deeper and deeper holes, sadly.
So you're saying select an older stud. If I'm looking for a new stud, the problem is there's a lot of breeders, but they want to stick with themselves. And if you're not in their group, then they don't want to sell breeding stock.
Yeah, it's a huge problem in Shelties, Pembrokes, Papillons. There are some breeds that simply don't let new people in. And you have to do the best you can to try and find the dogs that fit your goals. And I know it can be a very long, hard search. I don't have an easy answer, except sort of look for the ways that does give you access and do your best to do them. You know, so sometimes that may be showing in confirmation or going to confirmation shows, being a steward, joining a club, even if you don't want to show in confirmation, if that's the way you're going to get good stock, then you're going to take some time and you're going to go set up rings and.
Well, right judges. Now they're not even doing most of the shows.
I think they'll be coming back. We'll see. But joining a kennel club and joining your breed club are two really good ways to do it. And then when you join, volunteer to do something. And okay. I know it's hard. You know, I've been obedience chair for 20 years and president of the local club and vice president of the local club. I was never treasurer, never wanted to do that. But, you know, committees, that I find is a really helpful way to connect with people who have the dogs that you want. If you want field dogs and retrievers, join a retriever club. Go help at Hunt Tests, you know. Okay, so I've talked your ear off. We are way over time, but great, great conversation today, guys. I think I only have the one to do, except I have to go finish the poop webinar, just saying. But I will put up the terrier and the veggie research in the Facebook group so that you can read it and sort of process it. And it's a very interesting study. So thanks, guys. Wonderful to see you. This will be up tomorrow or the next day if you want to go back and review it. Otherwise, I will see you on Facebook and poop. I will see you then. Bye, guys.